Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
A 16-year-old in Sweden may be at the center of a far-reaching computer security breach. Today's New York Times reports that investigators think the teenager and maybe some of his friends stole the programming instructions for computers that control the Internet, in some cases stole them right out from under the eyes of cybersecurity experts. Investigators now think the teen may also have compromised computers serving NASA, the American military, and major universities. Well, joining us on the line is former hacker Kevin Mitnick. His new book is titled The Art of Intrusion, The Real Stories Behind the Exploits of Hackers, Intruders, and Deceivers. Kevin, hello.
Hey, good morning.
And remind ourselves, as a teenager in the 1980s, you were convicted of hacking. You were even on the FBI's most wanted list. Obviously, now that's in your past. This current incident we're speaking of began with a break-in at Cisco Systems Network, a system that helps control the Internet, and it took place last year. To the uninitiated, how is that done?
Well, apparently, the perpetrator was inside a university or in a computer laboratory computer somewhere in the United States, and the system administrators were watching him break into Cisco, and apparently what he had done is he placed a backdoor, basically secret programming instructions in a program that allowed him to obtain valid usernames and passwords to a system at Cisco, and then he was able to log into that system and supposedly steal the source code to some of the Cisco routers.
Well, how far-reaching did that breach become?
Well, as far as into Cisco, from what I read, it appeared that the attacker had breached one system, but with access to that one system, he was supposedly able to obtain the source code to one of the Cisco operating systems, which is extremely valuable to an attacker.
Yeah, and now investigators are saying it has become part of a much broader network, much broader operation. And to read of it, it sounds like the computer equivalent of flesh-eating disease, that investigators could see it at work, but they couldn't protect systems in time.
Yeah, because during the investigation, they were able to monitor the intruder at a university and at some of the supercomputer laboratories. And during the monitoring, they're actually seeing the attack in real time, but because it's in real time, they're unable to get hold of the victim and let the victim know what was going on before the thefts took place or before the unauthorized access took place.
Yeah, and investigators think the teenager called himself Staccato, with two Ks, when he was sending emails and online. And he boasted of hacking into NASA computers, stealing F-18 blueprints from air stations in Maryland, and hacking into computers at the University of California in Berkeley. Now, the military is denying that he got the F-18 blueprints, but how significant do you think are these claims?
Well, he's probably breached into these particular systems. I doubt very highly he obtained any classified material, but his motivation sounds like he was doing it for the bragging rights.
And which often happens.
Yeah, some different hackers have different motivations. In this case, apparently he wanted to gain intelligence like the Cisco source code that would help him attack other systems, and also probably for the bragging rights so he could brag to his peers about his accomplishments.
And apparently he took things personally when he saw one person at a university write about him in an email and call him a hacker. He wiped out her entire email storage. Well, how should companies view this? What should they do now?
I think it should be a wake-up call, because apparently how the hacker was able to breach these systems was exploiting known vulnerabilities that apparently there are already security patches available. And unfortunately, the victimized companies were not diligent enough to install these security patches. So what I recommend is that companies really think about their patch management process to ensure that their computers don't end up being the low-hanging fruit for some 16-year-old in Europe.
Yeah. Now, the New York Times is reporting that the attacks have stopped since this 16-year-old has been caught. With the few seconds we have, how confident are you that they won't start up again if he had friends?
Well, probably the friends are scared to death. I mean, if their friend was arrested and there's an FBI investigation, it's very logical for them to stop their activity. But if it blows over and they're not identified, they'll probably continue sometime in the future.
And by the way, Kevin, did you serve time?
Yes, I did. I served about 5 years in federal custody.
Cautionary tale. Author and former hacker Kevin Mitnick, he wrote the book The Art of Intrusion, The Real Stories Behind the Exploits of Hackers, Intruders, and Deceivers. Kevin, thank you.
Thank you.
Around 500 people crammed into the auditorium of Boston University's Psi Center last night to spend an evening with Jane Fonda.
Good evening. Barnes & Noble at BU would like to thank you for coming out tonight and tonight's special guest, the two-time Academy Award-winning actress, activist, philanthropist, producer, and author, Jane Fonda.
And as we learn in her memoirs, Jane Fonda is also the daughter of an aloof acting legend and a mother who committed suicide. She's the ex-wife of three famous men and the mother of two children. She's the anti-war activist who inspires admiration and outrage, the creator of the best-selling videos of all time, Jane Fonda's Workout, and a woman who battled a lack of self-worth and eating disorders, had breast implants put in and taken out, and recently became a Christian. When Jane Fonda decided to make a film about her life for her 60th birthday, her daughter, Riley, suggested, "Why don't you just have a chameleon walk across the screen?" That remark prompted Jane to write her new memoir, My Life So Far, to find out who she really was.
And Jane Fonda's quest has apparently struck a note with a lot. She is now number one on the New York Times bestseller list. So please welcome author Jane Fonda.
As moderator of the evening, I was aware there was some trepidation on the part of organizers. Jane was spit on by a Vietnam veteran in Kansas City. Tonight, before coming on stage, she asked for a hug, then received her first of several ovations. I started by asking about her book tour so far, and especially that Kansas City heckler.
Well, most of the things that I'm hearing from Vietnam veterans were expressed, for example, in a letter that I got yesterday, and I'm getting scores and scores of letters. This guy who was in the Army, he said, I've hated you for decades. I would never read a book about you. I would never see a movie you were in. I've read your book. I now understand the context. I forgive you, and you cannot know what this means to me to be able to say those words. That's the kind of thing that I'm hearing more. There was an incident of spitting. It was a minor incident. It's sad. It's sad, because what it means is that particular person doesn't understand the war. The problem is that we haven't come to terms with the Vietnam War, and until we do, there will be people who think that we lost the war because of the liberal media, you know, or the anti-war activist, which, of course, is hogwash. It was not a war that could be won. It was based on lies, just like this one in Iraq is. And it's very important that there be a myth. And I'm a perfect lightning rod for the myth. But there's a lot of healing taking place.
But I want to hasten to let you point out that you have your regrets as well about your trip to Hanoi.
Everything needs a context. I came late to the Vietnam War. It was 8 years into the war when, because of soldiers, I realized that this was not the war my father fought in the Pacific. Nixon was making us think that he was ending the war when, in fact, he was escalating it. And the dikes were being bombed in North Vietnam, which could, according to Kissinger, have led to 200,000 people starving. And I went there to expose that. I'm proud that I did. The bombing stopped a month after I got back. But at the last day I was on, the last day that I was in North Vietnam, soldiers sang me a song, and they asked me to sing one to them, and I was singing and clapping and crying and laughing, and I was led over, and I sat on a gun, and pictures were taken, just like this, and it wasn't until I got up and walked away that I realized, oh my God, this is going to send an image that is antithetical to who I am and what I stood for. I'd spent 2 years working with soldiers, opened the GI office in Washington to help process complaints from GIs. I did the FDA show in the Pacific. I'd been working with soldiers.
That is a deep regret, that you sat on the gun.
Oh my gosh, yes.
But not that you went.
No, it was, I feel that it was a patriotic thing to do, to go and try to expose the lies.
Do you feel that you led to the deaths or torture of POWs, which is something?
No, that's an internet hoax that's been going on since the mid-90s. We don't know who's behind it. The people who were said to have been tortured because of me have themselves said it's not true. The head of the POW MIA organizations, Mike McGrath, has said this is it's a hoax, it's all a lie. But, you know, they need to keep this myth going. You know, it's just like what happened during the Kerry campaign.
And by the way, did you ever, because of that, the Kerry campaign, the recent anniversary, did you ever think, well, maybe now is not the time for this book, or was now
the time? On the contrary. I didn't really know Kerry, but I heard him speak.
Wait a minute, you didn't know Kerry? I thought you were photographed together.
Well, that was something that the Bush administration, they rigged these photos to make it look like Kerry and I were standing side by side. It wasn't true, but I don't understand why John Kerry didn't own the courage that he represented back then. I mean, what is braver than to volunteer to go into a war to fight for your country, even if the war is wrong? That is a noble thing to do, to get there and realize that it's wrong, that it's betraying your country, and to come back and have the guts to say, Why John Kerry didn't own that more, I don't know, because it was an awesome thing that he did.
Last night, we moved through several topics, including the first advice she received from a director.
When the movie's over, you should break your jaw and have your teeth reset so you'll have, you know, more sunken-in look.
Given that...
If you have body issues, Hollywood isn't the place you want to go
exactly.
to, okay?
Exactly. Exactly. Somebody else tells you to wear falsies in a...
Jack Warner said, I won't allow her to be in this movie unless she wears falsies.
We also touched on what it was like to produce and star in On Golden Pond with her father, Henry Fonda, and Katharine Hepburn.
Miss Hepburn, when she met me, I don't like you. She was a prickly relationship.
What was that like for you to make On Golden Pond and put on the screen a lot of we identified with it in the audience, but you had lived at least part of it.
It was a mitzvah.
A mitzvah.
It was a blessing.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine. You understand a little bit from what we said already what kind of relationship I had with my dad. It was kind of like the character in the movie with Norman Thayer. That I was able to produce the movie that won him his Oscar. That we were able to perform that kind of relationship with each other. I mean, it's just, you know, it doesn't happen in life. I just feel so blessed.
Was that as hard as I would think it would be?
It was so close to real that every time I would read the script or rehearse it, the tears would come out this way. But it was so close to real when the time came to really shoot it. I totally shut down. I was too scared. We have to have, you know, the character of my mother that Katharine Hepburn plays, she said to me, you know, and you have to forgive him, Chelsea, and you just have to know he's doing the best he can. You know, we have to have such compassion for our parents, understand why they're the way they are, and be able to forgive them and get on with our lives.
Jane Fonda speaking last night at Boston University. When we come back, we'll have more, including Vietnam vets speak to Jane. And later, the mayor of Spokane, Washington, takes a leave of absence after a sting set up by the local newspaper catches him trying to meet a teenage boy online. What are some of the ethical and journalistic issues raised by this story? There's more coming up here and now. With author Jane Fonda at Boston University's Psy Center. In her new memoir, My Life So Far, Jane writes about the film Coming Home. I asked her where the idea came from, but first, a scene from the Academy Award-winning film starring John Voight as the physically disabled Vietnam vet.
What are you doing here, Bender? Why aren't you out on the golf course teeing up balls, doing something you're good at?
I'm just trying to keep busy, that's all.
Sure, it gives you something to talk about over martinis, how you're helping out the poor cripples.
I don't think that I deserve that, Luke, at all.
Maybe you're just getting ready for your husband, Luke, and back in a body bag.
Luke! Stop! Stop and listen to me! What is the matter with you? Why do you have to be such a bastard?
I spoke with Ron Kovic. Did you see Born on the 4th of July?
Yes.
You know, that was his story? Yeah. He'd re-upped to Vietnam 3 times, came back, ended up in a wheelchair, paralyzed from the waist down. We were speaking together at an anti-war rally at Claremont College in California. Here's what he said. He looked at the students and he said, I may have lost my body, but I've gained my mind. And those words penetrated me. I thought you could make a movie about that. And we did. It wasn't quite the way I originally envisioned it, but I wanted to make a movie that showed the reality of the returning Vietnam veterans and how it was the ones that couldn't let go of the macho ethic that broke. Whereas the ones like John Voight in the movie, who they may have lost their body, but they understood. And it kind of said that, too.
During the question and answer session that followed, two Vietnam vets were first to the mic, the first to speak, the one apparent critic in the room.
You were on the side of the bad guys, the killers, the communists. You were rooting for them to win. To use your word, rooting for them to win.
You were on the side
of the corrupt North Vietnamese communists, to use your word again, corrupt, which you apply to the South Vietnamese, interestingly enough. So to bring this to the current day, you have made connections between what's going on in Iraq and Vietnam.
Yeah.
You have belittled us, talked about lies, et cetera, et cetera. So the question becomes, are you once again on the wrong side of this issue? Are you rooting for the bad guys to win in Iraq? Are you rooting for us, America, and our allies, to lose?
Well, I'm sad that you still don't get it. I did not root for the bad guys to lose. I'm not even defining who the bad guys are in either case. The war never had to happen. I'm talking about the Vietnam War now. It never had to happen. The fact that the quote-unquote, your version of bad guys won, and still Americans flock there as tourists, comment on how nice the people are to them, spend billions of dollars there, we are so heavily invested there. That could have happened without 58,000 American lives and millions of Indochinese lives being lost. Yeah. It never had to happen.
What about the second part of the question?
Hi, Jane. I'm just another Vietnam vet that's still fond of Jane. I met you at Valley Forge, I think, in 1970, and I've been in the streets with you for 35 years. We welcome you to Boston. The Vietnam vets of Boston love you.
And those were the night's only references to the war that still wounds. The appeal of Jane Fonda seems to be that with so many facets to her life and with her willingness to talk about them, there is at least one that people can relate to.
If you can speak a little bit about your mom and her suicide and how it affected your life.
My mother suffered from bipolar disorder. It was called something different back then. She killed herself when I was 12. You know, it can't help but affect a child because the parent can't really be present. And of course, when a parent commits suicide, the child always feels that it's because you weren't good enough. You know, that maybe if you'd just done a little bit more, if you'd been able to tell her that you loved her, but I wasn't sure I did. I dedicated my book to her.
I noticed that.
Because I knew that in order to heal, that I had to come to terms with her. But when I started the book, I didn't know what that would mean because, you know, my dad was, you know, he wrote it was biography and people have written about him and he was famous, but, you know, everyone that knew my mother, I thought, was dead. And then again, like miracles, people began to surface in my life that didn't even know I was writing a book, that knew her. And then, with the help of lawyers, I was able to obtain her medical records. I was about 2 years into writing the book when I got her medical records. And In the middle of the medical records was her history that she wrote herself. She wrote her life history. And I had always wondered, what happened to her? Well, she'd been sexually abused. And I had been studying sexual abuse at that time for 8 years, and I just was thirsty for wanting knowledge about what it meant, what does it do, and I didn't even know why. But because of that, the moment that I saw that she had been sexually abused, everything fell into, I understood everything. Because when a girl is sexually abused, it's a form of brainwashing. Her sense of parameters are gone. Her sense of agency, the girls tend to become promiscuous, and they tend to feel guilty which seems preposterous. Why would a young child feel guilty? But they always do. It was both, oh, I felt so sorry for her, but I could forgive her so totally. And myself, I could forgive myself too.
You did forgive her?
Totally forgive her, yes.
I was always ashamed of the fact that my mom committed suicide when I was 17. I came here to Boston University as a student, actually. I felt totally ashamed to tell anybody. You couldn't share. And I saw you being interviewed by Larry King, and I said, I've got to go see her, and I happened to be.
Yes.
I feel very proud to share some.
Thank you.
Something with you.
Thank you so much.
And thank you very much.
Forgiveness is everything.
Yes.
You said it in so many different ways. Fabulous.
Thank you.
I so admire you.
Thank you, Debbie.
Jane Fonda, speaking and signing books last night at Boston University's Tsai Center. Her new best-selling memoir is called My Life So Far. Stay with us. More ahead here and now.
Our first famous person.
James West, the mayor of Spokane, Washington, says he's taking a leave of absence after a local newspaper reported allegations that he had molested at least two boys decades ago, and that more recently he solicited sex from teenage boys on a gay website. The newspaper is also reporting allegations that Mayor West provided government jobs for young men he met online. West, a staunch opponent of gay rights during his time in office, has admitted he's gay as a result of the sting, but he denies all the other allegations. And he's accusing the newspaper, the Spokesman Review, of persecuting him because the newspaper hired the man who posed as a teenager on the internet and entrapped West. Well, since the Spokesman Review published its expose, many have questioned whether the newspaper's undercover activities fall within the boundaries of ethical practice. Here's newspaper editor Stephen Smith during an interview with National Public Radio on how that decision was reached.
Was actually quite an agonizing decision, and one that we spent a considerable amount of time in the newsroom debating. Fundamentally, it came down to two issues. There was no other way to absolutely confirm, without doubt, that the mayor was online using the screen names on gay.com, and potentially we were dealing with a situation where children and young people were at risk, and that overrode our other considerations.
Mark Cherkowitz is media analyst for the Boston Globe. Mark, we're hearing that some people in Spokane are siding with the mayor. They're agreeing that he's being persecuted because he's gay. What are you seeing as some of the unintended consequences of this investigation?
Well, I mean, the first thing we should say is that, you know, I don't mean to be cynical, but, and I'm not even referring specifically to this case, but obviously, you know, if somebody in the news media cured cancer, there would be 10% of the population that would be angry at the news media tomorrow. So obviously, anytime we sort of engage in controversy and report controversial things through controversial methods, we're going to upset people, and there are people who are constantly upset about us no matter how we do our job. Obviously, there are a lot of hot-button issues that are involved here, including, you know, sexual orientation. And the tricky issue for journalists always, and this one seems to have crossed the line clearly, is, you know, when does someone's alleged private behavior cross into their public existence and affect the lives of someone other than simply he and his friends and family? And in this case, that seems clearly to have happened.
Well, now let me ask you about that. Let's talk about what the newspaper did. They set up this online situation where they set up a fake 17-year-old writing letters in a chat room, put him out there as bait, if you will, to see if the mayor would bite. He did. They did this because they were investigating child abuse in the Catholic diocese, and a priest, they say, tipped them off that the mayor might have been in these chat rooms. Are you saying that that was unethical for the paper to do, to put that bait out there?
I think that's problematic. A lot of us in the journalism business think a line is crossed when essentially the media become cops and do their job as cops would do their job. Now, whether you would call it entrapment or whether you would call it something else, I think you have to be very wary of essentially that kind of deception being practiced by media organizations. I know in this case that the newspaper thought long and hard about the decision that it had to make, that it took a number of factors in consideration. I will say one thing. It doesn't look like it was an off-the-cuff decision, nor was it one that was taken lightly. And there's a history of doing this in journalism, but frankly, I think it's very problematic. To my way of thinking, there are a couple of things you need to think about when you take steps even similar to this. One is obviously the importance of the story, and arguably it's quite important. The other, frankly, is, are there alternative ways of getting the story, even if it takes longer, even if it's painstaking, even if it involves filtering through off-the-record interviews? And then lastly, are you sort of willing to stand up to the consequences here? The most famous case of deception in media history, I think, was the Mirage Bar, which was literally a bar set up by the Chicago Sun-Times to ferret out municipal corruption in Chicago. It worked like a charm. People, my understanding, recollection is people were arrested, reforms were passed. I mean, it was the classic sort of, you know, investigative journalism piece. And when it came time for the Pulitzer Prize, it did not win because, you know, the view of many in the business is, hey, that's a great hit, but that's not how we do investigative journalism. And I
by
I
stinging
feel the same
someone,
way.
By setting somebody up, is not the way.
Exactly. We don't function like cops. You know, our job isn't to catch bad guys by essentially or wrongdoers by essentially entrapping them by that kind of level of deception. If you got to spend, you know, a lot more shoe leather to get the job done, that's the way to do it, I think.
Well, you also mentioned something else, the public versus the private, and you questioned whether the private life of someone should be investigated. Even in the case of a mayor like Mayor West, who's been so publicly an opponent of gay rights issues, isn't that an hypocrisy?
Let me draw two distinctions here. From everything I know about the case, I think that the mayor's sexuality and his orientation is fair game, okay? In my book, it has crossed the line from private behavior into public life.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, you know, the hypocrisy factor, which we call it in the business, is a trigger for allowing someone's private life, again, to be looked at. When a politician does something in public and does the opposite in private, or when his public persona is opposite of his private life, we call the hypocrisy factor, that also makes it, in my book, fair game. So let me make a distinction here. I think what was found out about the mayor is fair game. It does seem to have been more than a private problem. It does seem to have been, in some levels, if these allegations are right, an abuse of power. There's also enough hypocrisy here to justify it. The question is, how do you get at that story? Mm-hmm. And I don't think, my feeling is, it's a legitimate story. The problem, is, fundamentally, is how it was reported.
The fact that young men were hired by the mayor off of these chat sites, doesn't that Does that change your mind at all? Does that make it fair game to go into one of those chat rooms as a newspaper reporter?
No, I have to hold to my fundamental position, which is no. I mean, the truth of the matter is, and this is what makes it harder, and this is what's frustrating, and this is where I understand the Spokane paper's problem. You want to get at that story. It's an important story. There's no doubt about it. But if these people exist, and in point of fact, they were hired that way, and they were sexually harassed, then they're out there to be found, and they're out there to be found by traditional methods, and they're out there to be interviewed by reporters, and what I'm saying is, if in fact this happened, then there are other ways to report that story. Even if it takes 2 or 3 months longer, however long it takes to find these people, you know, then you talk to them. And, of course, then you're going to get into the issue of confidential sources and not wanting to be identified. So there's no easy way to report a story this complicated and this sensitive. But, obviously, if these people exist and they have a story to tell, you need to find that the way to report the story other than through what most people would call, or many people would call, entrapment.
Boston Globe media analyst Mark Jerkowitz. Mark, thank you.
You're welcome, Robin.
And we welcome your thoughts on this or anything on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. Still to come, Tiger Woods is one of the topics in the new play from August Wilson. We'll have a review of the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright's new work. You're listening to Here and Now. The New York Times is planning a series of far-reaching changes in an attempt to boost reader confidence, shaken since 2003 when reporter Jason Blair admitted to plagiarism and making up facts. An internal committee is recommending that the paper make reporters and editors easier to reach by email, cut back on the use of anonymous sources, and increase coverage of Middle America rural areas and religion. This comes as stock in the New York Times Company is languishing, and the Times faces numerous challenges in a rapidly evolving media world. Well, joining us with more on what's happening at the Times is here now business reporter Mark Mills. Mark, welcome.
Hey, Robin.
And what is the Times hoping to accomplish with these reforms?
Well, you know, the New York Times underwent a serious period of introspection following that Jason Blair scandal a couple of years ago. Shortly after the Blair revelations, executive editor Howell Raines and managing editor Gerald Boyd were fired. Then the Times was frequently attacked from both the right and left during the 2004 election. The new executive editor, Bill Keller, says the Times was deluged with what he said were ferocious letters berating us for either being stooges of the Bush administration or agents of Michael Moore. So the Times decided it needed to make some changes to ensure the quality of its journalism, to provide broader coverage of what's happening in Middle America, and to be more accessible to email from readers and to develop a way to kind of better evaluate and respond to criticism of the paper.
Well, we mentioned some of the committee's recommendations. What else is the Times going to do?
Well, the recommendations have included having the paper's top editors write regular columns explaining the editorial process, to systematically track errors in the paper to prevent them from recurring, to use the web to show complete documents or transcripts of interviews used in stories. Overall, they really want to step up efforts to improve accuracy and provide new transparency of the process of writing and editing the paper.
Well, and you know, we don't tend to think of newspapers as a business story, but of course you do. And while the Times attempts to shore up its standing as a great newspaper, it's also facing challenges on that business front. The lagging stock price to declining newspaper readerships nationwide, we know about that. Everybody's online. How uncertain is this future?
Well, you know, for everybody in the media business these days, it's a pretty uncertain future. It's exciting times, but unpredictable. Times company stock peaked at almost $54 a share back in 2002. It now trades at around $33 a share, and revenues have been pretty flat for the past 5 years at the New York Times Company. Company chairman Arthur Oak Sulzberger Jr. acknowledged at the company's annual meeting a couple of weeks ago that the stock price has underperformed for far too long. And he talks about the Times facing a very volatile advertising market, audience fragmentation, a rapidly evolving digital revolution, and a growing consumer control of their own media experiences. These are things really all media are facing.
Well, I was going to ask, in addressing these issues, is the Times behind other companies?
They are. Like the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal, the Times is a family-controlled company with a long tradition and commitment to high-quality journalism, even at the expense of fatter profits. You know, many other newspapers and media businesses have long since been taken over by bottom-line corporations that have been squeezing newsroom budgets for years. Media companies such as Gannett and Knight Ridder have not been spectacular, but both stocks have outperformed the Times in recent years. The Times has the challenge of continuing to provide top-flight journalism with its high costs while competing in a bare-knuckle advertising world, all while we're having a digital revolution going on and consumer behavior is changing.
And in the minute we have left, what is the Times doing to turn that competitive situation around?
Well, they're moving on a lot of fronts, Robin. First, on the newspaper front, they've taken the paper national. You can now get home delivery of the Times in 318 markets. Nearly half the paper's daily subscribers live outside of New York. NYTimes.com is one of the most visited news-oriented websites. In fact, a majority of the Times readership now sees the paper online, but they don't pay for that privilege. They go there and get it for free. The Times web businesses, which include Boston.com here in Boston, take in millions in advertising revenue, but still 90% of the company's income comes the old-fashioned way through newspaper advertising and circulation.
So the Times is going to have to figure out the questions that a lot of papers are trying to figure out. You know, will people pay to subscribe to an online edition? Questions like that.
Absolutely. A lot of big media questions for companies like the Times and many other media players to figure out what the new digital revolution means, what the new distribution systems will be, what will pay in the future and still maintain high quality.
Mark Mills, Here and Now's business reporter. Mark, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. predictions of the demise of serious drama on Broadway may be premature. The play Doubt is receiving bouquets from critics and took home this year's Pulitzer Prize. And now critics are eagerly awaiting August Wilson's new play, Radio Golf, the last in his epic 10-play series dedicated to the African-American experience. Wilson won 2 previous Pulitzer Prizes. Some are wondering if this could win him a 3rd. Here now's theater critic Bill Marks is here with us to talk about both shows. Hi, Bill.
Thanks, Robin.
Well, let's talk about Doubt first. Playwright John Patrick Shanley, best known for his screenplay for the film Moonstruck with Cher.
Yes.
So many people might think that this is also a comedy.
And it isn't. It's a serious drama about a serious subject set in a Catholic school in 1964. And it's about Vatican II partly because we have a father there, Father Flynn, who is very much into the sort of liberated church. And we have Sister Alyosius, who is very much of the old school. She begins to suspect that Father Flynn's relationship with some of the students is not quite right, enlists another nun to start sort of spying on him. And what's interesting about the play is not only that it's such a good sort of slice of life of what happens at the Catholic school, the sort of ideological and religious battles of the period, but it legitimately sticks to its title. It is about doubt in all of its different forms. And even though the Sister Alyosius is absolutely convinced that she is correct, even she indicates at some points that there may be some doubt.
So a little less dogma than doubt.
A little less dogma and a little doubt, but it's about essentially protecting the dogma and protecting the children by following what you believe is to be the truth. And Shanley's great to the extent that he doesn't settle the issue. It's really left unresolved whether Father Flynn is guilty of something or not.
Timing couldn't be better. Is that part of his success or is it just so darn good?
Part of it, it's its timing. Part of it's so darn good. Part of it is that Cherry Jones, who's really a wonderful actress, is playing Sister Alyosius. And she is a absolute bulldog. And there are confrontations in this between Father Flynn and the character that Cherry Jones plays, Sister Alyosius, which are lacerating in the sense that both of them are going at one another because both of them know that their careers or their beliefs are on the line. One scene is an interesting one, and it's where Sister Alyosius is talking to the other nun and has already started begun to enlist her McCarthyite as a spy on Father Flynn.
But it's so unsettling to look at things and people with suspicion. It feels as if I'm less close to God.
When you take a step to address wrongdoing, you are taking a step away from God. But in his service, dealing with such matters is hard and thankless work.
And what happens at by the end, and I really don't want to give away the end of the play, but is only that both perspectives, the perspective of innocent before proven guilty and guilty if decided that you see enough indications, you have faith in your own intuition, square off. And that's what makes the play so I think so seductive and makes the play so interesting.
John Patrick Shanley's Doubt, which won the Pulitzer Prize for Best Drama. Well, now let's move to August Wilson. And we just were, it seems, talking about his last play, and now he's got the next one out.
But this is the last one.
The very last one.
The last one.
I mean, this cycle.
Gem of the Ocean, which is a play that just ran on Broadway and unfortunately did not have a particularly long run, is set in the turn of the century. In other words, the beginning of the last century. This latest play, Radio Golf, is set in the 1990s. So in a sense, with this play, Wilson is capping the entire series.
Remind us some of the other plays in the series.
People will be familiar with Fences, which won a Pulitzer Prize. They may be familiar with A Piano Lesson, which was made into a first-rate cable TV movie, and that won a Pulitzer as well.
So tell us about Radio Golf.
Radio Golf is, I think, an interesting, provocative play of his. It's in development. I think it's going to go through a number of different productions at various regional theaters around the country, and I think that will help. Right now it's at Yale Rep. It is set in the 1990s. It is about real estate. It's about the black middle class and about whether they're going to respect the past and criticize the American dream. And the American dream here is represented by Tiger Woods, the golfer. Mm-hmm. One of the black characters is absolutely just crazy about Tiger Woods. While another black character is a little more skeptical, but wants to run for mayor. And this is the mayor of Pittsburgh, which is where Wilson comes from. He sets it in the neighborhood he came from. Mm-hmm. And it's about the future of that neighborhood in the 1990s. There's one home left. It's an old house. It's a house which was the home of Aunt Esther, who, if you know the 10-play series, mm-hmm. it was a 300-year-old character whose lifespan started, she came over from Africa and somehow managed to live all the way through into the 20th century. It's her home.
Played by Felicia Rashad in the Gem of the Ocean.
And unfortunately, that is slated for demolition. And the political hopes and economic dreams of the two characters from the black middle class are pinned on this home being destroyed.
What are some of the elements of the past plays that he brings forth in this one as well?
Well, we have Aunt Esther literally as a character that is mentioned or is in most of the other plays.
Right.
But essentially, it's about the survival of black memories of pain and inequality. And in the American dream, where Tiger Woods is the triumphant figure, does that in some way ameliorate or remove the need to look back at the past and to look at that pain squarely? And, of course, Wilson's answer in this play quite loudly is no. And he essentially reunites two families which were broken apart in Gem of the Ocean. And they are brought together here. There's a scene in the play where the character who represents sort of the past talks about America as a broken slot machine. And I think this represents Wilson's idea very, very concretely.
Some people say the machine is supposed to take all the quarters. If it don't take all the quarters, what do? You fix it. Anybody with common sense would agree with that. What they don't agree on is how to fix it. Some people say you're supposed to tear it down to fix it. Some people say you're supposed to build it up to fix it. Some people say they don't know how to fix it. Some people say they don't want to be bothered with fixing it. You put them all together, you mix them together, and you got America.
That wonderful actor is Anthony Chisholm, who was also in A Gem of the Ocean. And I think he's speaking sort of for Wilson here, saying that here it is, the 1990s, and America is still broken. It still needs to look at its past. It still hasn't reconciled itself to those sins. And there's still a lot of work to be done.
Well, Radio Golf, August Wilson's 10th play in his 10-play series, is now, as you said, at the Yale Rep Theater. Where do you think it stands in that pantheon? How do you think it matches up? And do you think it will definitely go to Broadway?
I don't know if it'll definitely go to Broadway. The sad fact of Wilson's work on Broadway is that each successive play that is open there has run less and less in terms of the time on The Great White Way.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the problem is that the plays have been getting progressively longer and longer. Gem of the Ocean was over 3 hours. What's good about Radio Golf is that it's considerably shorter. At this point, it really needs some work to sharpen and hone itself. But I'll tell you, I would put it sort of in the middle. I wouldn't put it in the tip top with Joe Turner's Come and Gone and perhaps Fences. But I would not make it, I don't think it's as weak as such plays as King Headley.
Plus it has mention of Tiger Woods, if not Tiger Woods. I mean,
we've got a poster of Tiger Woods right in.
Well, there you go.
But he's unfortunately seen as a sort of villain in this.
Oh.
In the sense that he's seen as his sort of, his form of success is seen as capitulating essentially to the white ideas of what the American dream is. And I think what he's saying in this play is that Africans, Americans have to begin to shape the American dream their way rather than having it shaped by the larger society.
Mm. Well, discard that great marketing idea I was thinking of, inviting Tiger Woods to the opening or something like
that.
Yeah,
I'm afraid that August will have to think about other ways to make his play make it on Broadway.
Here Now's theater critic Bill Marks. For more information on both The Doubt and Radio Golf, check out our website, here-now.org. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Kevin Sullivan, Matt Largy, Karen Miller-Metzen, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Tim Skog. Our web producer is Ken George. Our newscast producer, Deborah Becker. Our interns are Kate Goldring and Danielle Dreilinger. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next.